lights of the nearby town were easy to see in the sharp, clear night. It was just two clicks away. The border was 100 meters on the other side of the pipeline. Marcus put on his night-vision goggles. "Pad's got a point about the thrash ball. You bet anything on the score?" "I'm not a betting man. Especially since the Eagles signed that new guy, Cole. Cole Train. Yeah, that's about right. He's a machine. I'd hate to run into him in a dark alley. He'd rip your head off for a laugh." Normal life went on, and it kept you sane. Even war could be boring when you weren't fighting and close to shitting yourself. It swung between the extremes. Carlos understood perfectly how some guys needed the adrenal buzz, even when they knew they were shortening their odds of survival. And he thought of Marcus telling his dad that the army was probably the only place he'd ever feel alive. It was true, and it wasn't about cheap thrills. It was about knowing you'd used every cell that life had given you to its limit. Carlos had felt exactly the same way when he listened to his own father talking about his time as a gear. Cocooned civilian life never let you find out what you could really do, or pushed you hard enough to understand exactly who you were. It was a terrible thought that so many people could die having lived around the half-full level, never knowing more, never trying more. And there was no second chance. This was the only life you ever got. "Easier on foot." Marcus jumped out and waded into the snow in the shadow of the pipeline. It stood a couple of meters high, supported on concrete trestles at intervals. He pulled the hood of his snow camo weatherproof over his head. "And this, just to stop you from nagging me." The area was a big, shallow valley, a gentle scoop out of the landscape, and they were looking slightly downhill for what seemed like kilometers. Carlos slipped his NV goggles down from his forehead and looked around. They waited for nearly an hour, walking in small circles or up and down the line of the pipe to keep warm. Then something made Carlos hold his breath to listen. He put his hand out to get Marcus's attention and gestured, quiet. "Vehicle," Marcus whispered. It was a higher-pitched sound than a car, a smaller motor. There weren't even any roads to speak of, at least other than the track they were on. "Snow bike of some kind." That didn't make it suspicious. Lots of locals had snow bikes. They stood looking in the direction of the sound, and Carlos eventually picked out a small, wobbling point of light with a darker shape around it. As it got closer, it resolved into a heavily clothed figure on a twin-ski bike. Marcus slipped into the cover of the pipeline, and Carlos dropped down onto one knee, shoving his goggles onto his forehead to use the rifle's optics. He tracked the guy as the bike whined past, following the parallel line of the pipe inside the Marinday border. Could just as easily be a woman, of course. Marcus radioed Patrick. "Alpha 5 to 3-0. Possible trade for you. Ski bike heading your way, parallel with the pipeline."
"Roger that, Alpha 5.
Carlos started up the APC again, but killed all the lights.
"Baz might get to see the game after all."
"Let's not be too hasty."
Marcus called into base to report the possible contact.
"Might just be some poor jerk going home after a night in the bar."
The chances were that the noise of the ski bike's motor would deafen the rider to distant sounds behind him. And he was wearing a thick hood. Carlos kept it in as high a gear as he could while Marcus leaned out of the cab to follow the rider through his rifle's optics. The upward slope of the valley meant Marcus could see him over the top of the pipeline. The bike hugged that line all the way.
"If intel is right," Marcus said, "this guy will be the explosives drop.
We could just stop him, of course, check what he's carrying."
"Not while he's on the other side of the border."
"Who's going to get out the measuring tape and check?"
"We've got our ROEs. No cross-border stuff.
He's got to come to this side of the line to plant the explosive."
and then we can blow his brains out.
Marcus checked his scope again.
Legitimately. Satisfied?
It sounded stupid to Carlos, but then diplomatic rules usually did. That border jurisdiction shit was for cops, not wars. Eventually, Marcus gestured to slow down and dismount. They ducked down under the pipe and came out on the other side within 500 meters of Padrick's position. The ski bike had stopped almost level with the hole dug earlier in the day, and the rider was crouched down, checking through his pannier, still on the Marinday side of the border.
3-0. Can you see anything? Marcus whispered.
Negative, Alpha 5. He's still just a dickhead messing with his bike until he makes a move for that hole.
And then maybe he's really going to check a snare.
Carlos kept his rifle trained on the man. The night was silent except for the wind and the faint sounds of the guy handling something in his pannier. He had to have heard the APC come to a halt. He was far enough ahead when he switched off the bike's motor to notice the noise and the sudden silence. But he carried on rummaging. Maybe he was a genuine hunter after all. He had his back to them now, but not to Padrick and Baz.
Alpha 5. Whatever it is he's taking out, there's a lot of it.
Padrick's voice was hard to hear, even in Carlos's earpiece.
I've seen the things they hunt. They're tiny. You could stun them with your toothbrush.
Got him.
I've got a shot now. Tell me when I'm clear to take it.
It was Marcus's call. Bike guy was standing upright now, still on the Marinday side of the border, still oblivious to 3 rifles trained on him, any one of which would spoil his entire day. Carlos could understand why it would be a bad idea to leave a harmless Marinday citizen with a cog round in their skull, but he thought it was worth the risk. Marinday was an enemy in all but name, so how much worse could things get, other than pissing off a few diplomats and politicians? And they didn't count for shit.
Let's see what he does,
Marcus whispered, lowering himself on one arm to prone position and taking aim. The scope's NV filter gave Carlos a pretty clear view of Bike Guy, but explosives didn't usually have a nice clear label on them. Whatever the man was handling, though, there was a lot of it. It looked like he was removing a stack of books or small sandbags. That was good enough for Carlos. The hard part was always deciding when to slot the bastards.
It's Pad's shot, Marcus whispered.
You're a mind reader. You're not big on patience.
Bike Guy turned with his arms full and walked toward the pipeline, across that invisible line that made him fair game, while Carlos watched. He heard Padrick inhale a few times before letting out a long, final breath. He was steadying himself to fire.
Any second now.
Bike Guy knelt by the hole, the last time he was ever going to do anything. Carlos had as good a close-up of his face as he was ever going to get. It was almost completely swathed in a ski mask and goggles, so there was no way of making a positive visual ID, even if he'd had that level of intelligence detail.
Go on, Pad. Take him.
Then, Bike Guy stopped dead. He looked up, glanced to his left. He couldn't possibly see or hear Padrick from there, so what the hell had spooked him? Then got to his feet. He was still holding some of the objects he'd taken from his pannier. He headed back toward the bike. It looked casual for a few steps, as if he'd forgotten something, but then he picked up speed.
"Pad, abort, abort, abort," Marcus said, abandoning radio procedure. "Leave him. We're pursuing."
Carlos was off even before Marcus finished the sentence. He put a burst of fire through the bike that chewed up its fuel tank and ripped through the steering, then plunged through the deep snow in pursuit.
"You're not going anywhere, asshole, and I can outrun you."
He could hear Padrick saying, "I've still got a shot! I've still got a shot!" Marcus was yelling at him to get back. Bike guy darted away at a right angle from the bike, heading for the border. Once he was over that, there wasn't much they could do, and Carlos wasn't going to let an indie sit there laughing at the cog like some kid playing tag. Maybe bike guy thought gears were too old-fashioned to shoot a saboteur in the back. Marcus was almost level with Carlos. It was like running in tar, forcing Carlos into a high, bounding movement to clear the clinging snow. Bike guy dropped something, but neither of them were going to stop now to check what it was.
"He'll be handy for intel to play with," Marcus panted.
The chase was almost in slow motion. It could have ended instantly with a single shot.
"Don't drop him unless we have to."
The guy kept going. If he was armed, Carlos couldn't see a weapon. That didn't mean much. The imaginary line that Carlos had superimposed on the featureless snow was getting closer. He had his rifle, his sidearm, his knife.
"You're over, Carlos, you're over!"
Padrick's voice filled his head. He had a better fix on the coordinates from his static position.
"Carlos, you're over the bloody border!"
"Tough shit," Carlos said, suddenly realizing that Marcus had fallen back. When he glanced over his shoulder for a second, Marcus had taken up a firing position and was aiming.
"I can get him!"
The guy wasn't a gear. He was fit, but he wasn't gear fit. Carlos tackled him from behind, more as an accidental and desperate lunge than a calculated move, but he had to stop him. Like a few more meters was going to make it any worse. Who was going to see this anyway? Who was going to file a complaint? Bike guy struggled in Carlos's grip and made the mistake of reaching into his jacket. Carlos had always wondered how he'd react to having to kill someone up this close, but he didn't even have to think about it. All that went through his mind was that it wasn't going to be him doing the dying. It was going to be the other bastard. There was no room for any other thought. He plunged his knife into the guy's neck before he even realized he'd drawn it. Cog Command, House of the Sovereigns, Ephira. Hoffman realized something big had shifted in the course of the war when he walked into the basement briefing room at HQ. He took off his cap and wondered if he'd been given the wrong location. It wasn't unusual to be summoned to briefings with minimal information for security reasons, but this was the first time he'd been given no information at all, and he could see he was seriously out of place and out of rank here. It wasn't just a gathering of Army officers. Navy and Air Corps top brass were waiting in the lobby, too, glittering with seniority. And then there were the suits, the intelligence staff and COG political advisors. It was a small gathering, but in terms of sheer authority, this was a summit. A bit rich for my blood. Maybe they want me to clean the latrines.
"You too, eh, Victor?" said a voice behind him.
He turned to see a naval officer he'd met a couple of years before. Michael Mitchell? His first name was Quentin, as far as he could recall, and he hadn't been the full captain he was now.
"Quentin!"
Hoffman said, extending his hand. He jerked his head in the direction of three admirals.
"What are we, then? The hired help? Bag carriers?"
Michelson, that was it.
"I'm not sure my boss even knows."
Michelson's collar bore the distinctive twin shark emblems of a submariner.
"And I don't know why I'm here, either. I'm just Captain D. Flotilla. So when told to front up, I face aft and salute."
D. Flotilla was an amphibious assault and special maritime operations. That told Hoffman something, although he wasn't quite sure what, for as long as he could remember, COG doctrine had been built around land warfare, artillery, armor, and infantry. All other assets had been a sideshow. Now two small elements, special forces and amphib, seemed to have front-row seats for a big show.
"Okay, so it's spec ops and frogs. Any other orphans here besides us?" Hoffman asked. "Only the Orbital Technology Division, as far as I can see. Odd cocktail."
The big carved doors to the main conference room eased open, and a secretary in a dark blue business suit latched them open. A polished island of tables gleamed beyond in a windowless room.
"Chairman Dalyell will be with you shortly, so please take your seats."
It was the first mention of the chairman that Hoffman had heard. He'd assumed this was a chief of staff's meeting, or a minister's. This raised the stakes enormously. Michelson followed him in, and they looked for their names on the tables. "What the hell am I supposed to contribute to this?" Hoffman had no problem telling the chairman what he thought of the COG's defense policy or any part of it, as long as the chairman didn't have a problem with being told. But part of him was afraid of being unable to supply answers. All he had with him was his wallet, ID card, pen, and keys. His attaché case, empty except for a pad of paper, had been taken by security like everyone else's. That was unusual, to say the least. Even the generals looked apprehensive. Hoffman took some comfort from that. Dalyell was a small, balding man in his 50s who would have passed for an accountant if he hadn't worn such sharp suits. His voice, though, could halt a battalion. He sat down, flanked by two assistants, and gestured at one to shut the doors while the other readied a projector.
"We're soundproofed in here, ladies and gentlemen," Dalyell said, "and soon you'll understand why we need to be. This briefing is on an absolutely need-to-know basis. Get the lights, will you, Maynard?"
The display panel flooded with light, and a map filled the frame. The coastal plain of the Austri Republic, an independent state with a lukewarm alliance with its much bigger and more aggressive neighbor, Pels. The room fell completely silent. No fidgeting, no coughing, as Dalyell let the location sink in. Shit. The thought hit Hoffman between the eyes. We're going to invade Pels via Austri. About damn time. That'll bring it home to them. RTI Special Forces inserted to prep the battlefield before the amphib assault. Got it. He felt better already. He glanced at Michelson, but the man's eyes were fixed on the map as if he was thinking something else entirely.
"I want you to note a feature on the map," Dalyell said, swiveling his seat to peer at the assembled officers in the gloom. "You're going to be hearing a lot about it, at least within the confines of this room. It's called Asfo Point, and if we don't do something about it, it's going to be the end of the coalition." "Agent Satil, would you care to bring us up to speed?"
Bang. That was the problem with assumptions. They were short-lived, fragile things. Hoffman's few moments of thinking he'd worked out what was coming had evaporated. Satil walked up to the side of the display and reached in with a battered metal rule to indicate the desolate coast. The key to the map showed the area as a mix of clay wetlands and salt marsh, with pockets of grazing land and woodland. The only features of military interest were a couple of small army bases, a string of gun batteries a long way to the north, and an avionics facility standing on a finger of land jutting into one of the many inlets, Asfo Point. There were plenty of targets just like this in the Union of Independent Republics. There were much bigger and more strategic ones, too. Satil turned to face the room, squinting against the light from the projector.
"These wetlands around Asfo Point were originally drained for farming a few centuries ago," she said. "They're still called Asfo Fields, but it's so isolated and inhospitable that it's of more use for secure defense installations than crops these days. The research facility at Asfo Point has been developing weapons guidance systems and avionics for the UIR for 20 or 30 years, so no surprises there. But now something's changed. Intelligence shows that routine avionics work has been farmed out a chunk at a time to other places, and Asfo Point has been turned over to a single project. It's now developing a satellite weapons platform. We've given it the code name Hammer of Dawn."
Well, shit. Hoffman's scalp prickled. How far ahead of us does that put the damn Indies?
Satil paused for the communal rumble of dismay that rolled around the table. Dalyell gave her a nod and took over.
If you think that's bad news, Dalyell said quietly, then chew on the fact that they could be ready to deploy it within a year. Our satellite platforms are still sitting in computer modeling systems. Theory. So now you know what you're here for. It's not enough to deny this technology to the enemy. We have to take it.
That ruled out an airstrike. Hoffman glanced at Michelson again, and this time their eyes met. They both knew what they were there for now. It seemed that a decision had been made long before anyone in uniform was asked for their assessment. Cog intelligence was driving this.
General Ivor, Dalyell said, before anyone leaves this room today, I want a plan for taking Asfo Point, seizing the technology, and neutralizing the facility, personnel included. And that plan has to be carried out within the next 6 months. This technology will end the war, for us or for the UIR, but it will be the end of it.
Ivor didn't miss a beat.
I want your priorities spelled out, Chairman, because, with due respect, stealing a research facility minus the bricks and mortar, which is what you're asking us to do, is a much taller order than puffing it out of action.
You just summed up my priorities in one, General.
Dalyell took his leave of the meeting. Ivor got up from his seat and stared down at something he'd scribbled on the notepad in front of him.
Let's crack on, then, people, he said at last. This is where we start Operation Leveler. In all the years the Coalition has been fighting, there's never been a more critical mission.
Hoffman had often felt he'd been born into the wrong era, and might have been happier in the more rugged and decisive days of Cirrus past. But this was what he'd been born for, even if he didn't yet know how it might turn out, or even what it was. He felt oddly happy. He knew better than to believe that a single victory could stop decades of fighting in its tracks. War wasn't that clear-cut. Politicians weren't that smart. But they could hasten the end. He tried to imagine what a world at peace would be like, and if there would be room or purpose in it for men like him.
Chapter 7
I don't know why you're whining. Yes, Gears do deserve more rations than the rest of us. They're fighting to protect us all day, every day. It's a hard, heavy job. You want skinny runts defending us from the Locust? We'd all be dead now. Pregnant women get extra rations because they need them too, but the rest of us just don't. People live longer on fewer calories anyway, and before E-Day, that was how a lot of Cirra lived. Why don't you all shut up and thank God we're still alive?
Angry Jacinto citizen, at public meeting on changes to food rationing laws. Sarfuth, northern region, the wrong side of the Merindee border, 17 years ago, 3 years before E-Day. Marcus dropped down on the snow beside Carlos.
Shit, let's move him, come on.
It seemed crazy to be worried about such a small detail in a war that had spanned decades and killed so many millions. But wars pivoted on the small stuff, the assassinations, the footnotes. Carlos was on autopilot as he grabbed Bike Guy's ankles, while Marcus took his shoulders, but he remembered to pull his NV goggles back into place. The few meters to the border were harder than running 10 clicks. While they heaved the body through the snow, Padrick was scoping across the landscape with his NV filter, keeping an eye out for activity and muttering that he could have dropped the bastard on the right side of the border. At least Carlos had done it quietly. They bundled the body under the pipeline and squatted in the cover of the APC, staring out into the darkness. There was nothing they could do about the ski bike or the blood, but as far as Carlos was concerned, they didn't need to. It wouldn't do the Indies any harm to know they'd get slotted if they tried to sabotage installations in Cog territory, and that they weren't even safe across the border.
I'm going to check whatever he was placing in that hole, Marcus said, without needing to add that if it wasn't explosives, then they were in deep shit. Check the body.
I killed a guy. It wasn't the first time Carlos had used what the instructors delicately called lethal force, but this was different. It was personal. It felt like a bar brawl getting out of hand. His heart was pounding through his chest, and he didn't feel the way that he had when he'd returned fire on an enemy position or launched a mortar. And this wasn't the moment to try to make sense of it. He opened Bike Guy's jacket and felt around in the pockets. If it hadn't been for the wet fabric, blood, not water, it would have been like searching a drunk. He pulled out papers, a key ring, and a small pistol, not that firearms proved anything in this part of the world. Carlos turned the keys over in his hand. Shit. The key ring was a cartoon character of some kind, a bird. Long use had worn and battered it so much it looked like it had been chewed. But when he pushed back his NV goggles and shone his flashlight on it, he could see that the figure had been painstakingly repainted at least once. Whatever it was, it meant something to this guy. Carlos switched off the light and replaced his goggles before pushing back the guy's hood. Clean-shaven, maybe in his 30s. He put his thumbs under the edge of the snow goggles and forced them up. Carlos was caught off guard by the effect in his night vision. Bike Guy's eyes were staring up at him, just bright disks. He'd seen it 1,000 times on night patrol in living faces, but for a fraction of a second it froze him to the spot. He turned the head to one side to avoid the gaze. But the face was still a face, and he didn't look foreign, alien, different. He looked pretty much like anyone Carlos would have passed on the street at home. Shit. Why can't you look like the enemy? He muttered. Why don't you make it a bit easier? Bike Guy's documents didn't tell him anything except that he had a fishing permit and an identity card, both of which matched. Marcus crunched back and stood over him. So, he said, dropping a couple of objects in the snow next to Carlos. They looked like packets of sugar. Good call. Carlos picked up a pack and squeezed it, but the faint smell told him all he needed to know. It was a massive relief. Explosives. Military grade. He hadn't killed a hapless civvy out trapping animals. Well, his blowing shit up days are over, Carlos said, trying to sound like he knew all along. He knew just how close he'd come to causing the sort of incident that easily snowballed into something much bigger. We're shifting the body, right? Can't leave it here. Marcus was pissed off at him. It was a subtle thing, but Carlos was used to reading all the near-invisible signs, the way he finished the sentence on a falling note, the way he stood with his weight equally on both feet. Come on. Let's get on with it. Carlos could hear noises on his earpiece, the sound of Padrick puffing as he ran. He'd left his channel open. The two snipers were coming down the hillside, darting from outcrop to outcrop. They always assumed they were being observed. By the time Carlos had helped Marcus heave the body into the back of the APC, Baz was standing there waiting to mount up.
"Well, nothing else to hang around for," he said.
He was a square-built guy in his 40s, with a strong North Tyran accent. Carlos got the impression he never gave a second thought to the targets he dropped with Padrick.
I'm freezing. The novelty wore off about 2 days ago.
Padrick appeared behind him.
Shit, you're not taking your work home with you, are you? Leave the bastard.
It's not a combat situation, Marcus said. There'll be some regulation to cover this.
They returned to the FOB in silence, Marcus driving. Yes, there was a procedure for dealing with dead guys like that, as well as signing over the recovered explosives. The intelligence officer attached to the base moved in to take over. He seemed especially pleased with the ID papers, for reasons he didn't share with them.
Hey, the pipeline's still intact,
Padraic said as he walked into the barracks block.
Cheer up, Santiago.
Carlos cleaned out the back of the APC and went back out on patrol, this time with Marcus driving. They found more holes dug around the pipeline a few clicks south, but their edges were weathered and irregular, as if they'd been abandoned. They might even have been dug by animals. There were no more snares, just lots of tiny paw prints. It hadn't snowed in days. Marcus switched on the civilian radio on the dashboard, one hand pressed against his ear so he could still monitor voice traffic on his headset. "Want to listen to the game?" Carlos nodded. They listened at low volume, and it sounded like the Eagles were winning.
"Are Islanders interested in thrash ball?"
"Some of them. The islands aren't all one country, whatever we think." Marcus, jaw muscle twitching, seemed to be shaping up to say something.
"Okay, I take the corporal thing too seriously."
"What?"
"You were right. If you'd listened to me, we'd have lost him. Too much focus on SOPs.
It was a Marcus style of apology. But he didn't have to say sorry. Orders and procedures were there for a good reason, and Marcus was the one responsible if the thing had gone wrong. Carlos felt guilty.
"I still crossed into a neutral country and killed one of their citizens, even if his ID was fake and he was loaded with explosives."
"Yeah, well, it's not always in the manual. If I'd run out of luck like Harry's, I could have dragged Marin Day into the war for real." Carlos thought about it for a moment, not really hearing the thrash ball drama that was unfolding on the radio. He didn't feel as good as he should have. He felt he'd let Marcus down by doing something dumb and rash. You know, Dom would be so much better at this. He really loves the covert stuff. I'm built for basic soldiering. Give me a rifle and let me assault a target. Marcus might have smiled, or it could simply have been a grimace.
"We'll be okay when the weather warms up and the fighting season starts."
Yeah, Marcus took his corporal stripe very seriously, and seemed to think it made him personally responsible for the safety of every last gear in the cog. He was going to be pure obsessive hell when he made sergeant. But he was 19. They both were. Carlos thought of the guys their age who hadn't enlisted, and what they considered to be a hard time or a difficult decision, and realized they didn't have a clue. He felt better about himself, but he also realized he lived in another world. Who wouldn't want to serve, though? How can they live with themselves? Slotting bike guy was just a single incident in a long conflict, nothing special. The emulsion was still flowing. One more bad guy was out of circulation. But there'll be another bike guy along soon, and another, and another. It's like taking your hand out of a bucket of water. There's nothing to show you ever did a damn thing.
"I really want to make a difference," Carlos said.
Marcus stared ahead. The APC bounced over rockier ground as the Eagles scored again and tinny cheering filled the cab.
"How do we ever know which thing we do is really the one that changes history?" Marcus asked.
"I'll know," Carlos said. "I'll feel it." They lapsed into silence and listened to the rest of the game.
That guy Cole was like an avalanche, flattening everything in his path. Carlos wondered how much he was getting paid for this game.
Did he ever wonder what it was like to be 19 and freezing, with a dead guy's blood on your uniform, the most important things on your mind being a hot meal and calling your kid brother?
Maybe he did.
But Carlos doubted it. Dom Santiago's apartment, Lower Jacinto. Dom turned the key in the lock and waited in the hallway to listen for activity. 2 in the morning wasn't the best time to wake Maria, but he'd caught the first train he could get from camp without thinking too much about the time he'd reach Jacinto. He placed his kit bag on the floor and found something soft and squashy, It was a toy, Benedicto's fluffy dog, its ears chewed to rags. That meant his son could get to sleep without it. It also meant he was growing up fast. Dom switched on the lights and got halfway up the hall before he heard the bedroom door creak open. Maria stepped out into his path, clutching her bathrobe around her bump. She put her finger to her lips.
"I thought he'd never go to sleep. Why didn't you call to say you were coming?"
"I just jumped on the first train. Miss me?"
"Dumb question."
"I've got 15 days leave."
"You sure?"
"Yeah." Dom hadn't queried it. He'd learned fast not to make too many plans in the army. Maybe they gave us a few extra days for being good boys.
"Is that your way of telling me something?"
Dom had been busting a gut to tell her. He wanted to just show her, to take his combat jacket out of his grip and reveal the commando insignia now sewn under the shoulder, but that was too slow for a dramatic flourish. He simply reached into his coat and presented her with his fighting knife, hilt forward. Maria just stared at it.
"You passed."
"Yeah, I passed," he said. "I don't know how I kept my mouth shut this long." She took it in two fingers as if she didn't want to get fingerprints on it.
"You never said."
"I wanted to surprise you."
"It's real?"
She handed it back.
"I mean, you use it?"
"Yeah."
There were still moments when Dom felt he was a kid,
wildly unsure of himself. Yet here he was with a commando knife in his hand, and frontline combat experience, and a pregnant wife, and a baby sleeping in the next room. He wasn't even 18 yet. Sometimes, just sometimes, it all scared the living shit out of him.
"I'm really proud of you," Maria said. "But does this mean you won't be serving with Carlos and Marcus now?"
"Not necessarily." Dom opened the nursery door, a grand name for the box room he'd decorated, and leaned against the frame to watch Benedicto sleeping. "It just means I've got the skills there to call on if the battalion needs them. It's not like I'm in a permanent special forces unit."
Dom missed his brother and Marcus more than he'd ever thought possible.
But he couldn't trail around after them any longer. His reason was asleep in the cot. Once Dom had really understood the fact that he was a father, that he was now solely responsible for 3 other people whose needs wouldn't end for years, he found himself preoccupied by very different things. Part of him felt as if he'd abandoned his brother. Maybe that was what growing up actually felt like.
"You want some coffee?" Maria asked. "Have you eaten?"
"I'm fine."
"Then we ought to get some sleep."
She slipped past Dom to check on Benedicto. "I'm all wiped out." "I thought your mom was giving you a hand." Maria went back into the bedroom.
"I'm happier doing it myself. You know how it is."
Maria liked to do things her way. He couldn't blame her, because he wouldn't accept any help either. But babies were a lot of work, especially when you were expecting another one, and she didn't hang out with other army wives. She needed support when Dom wasn't there. He lay awake for most of what remained of the night, trying to work out tactful ways to have his folks keep an eye on her. It was hard to offer to babysit for a woman who didn't want to go out anywhere. Well, he had 15 days to try to coax Maria into a different way of doing things. She was an only child, like Marcus. They didn't always come to terms with having a bigger family around. 15 days, of course, would vanish fast. Dom found himself caught up in routine stuff like fixing shelves and buying stuff for the new baby. Carlos and Marcus got a 2-day pass. When the round of errands and visits was done, there was nowhere near enough time with Maria, proper husband and wife time. But they'd been inseparable since they were kids. Time wasn't really an issue. It wasn't as if he was still getting to know her. And he had no intention of getting killed, so the time they had ahead of them stretched into unimaginable infinity. The pendulum wars had reached some kind of equilibrium, however bad the individual battles were, and everyone got on with life as best they could. Human beings could adjust to any damn situation, Dom decided. With 4 days' leave left, Dom sat in his parents' yard with Benedicto on his knee, and wondered if he'd see out his time as a gear, a 30-year man. The army had never been demobilized in living memory.
"Has Marcus been to see his dad?" Maria asked.
"I think so."
"Sad, isn't it? Just the two of them, and such a gulf between them?"
"He'll be fine," Dom said. "He's a survivor, and he's got us." The tree where Dom had first seen Maria climbing the branches almost 7 years before was in full leaf, casting shadows on the Santiago's yard. Dom shut his eyes, reflecting on just how heavy babies could be when you carried them around for a while. He almost dozed off. He was sure he was still awake. But he wasn't. His father's voice jerked him out of a dream that he forgot as soon as he opened his eyes, and Benedicto wailed. Dom sat bolt upright, heart pounding.
"Sorry, son."
His father leaned over him and picked up Benedicto.
"Call for you. It's the adjutant."
Shit. Dom knew what he was going to hear even before he picked up the phone from the hall table.
"Private Santiago?"
"Dominic Santiago. It's me you want, Sarge, yes? Not Carlos?" The adj didn't say.
"You're recalled to RHQ immediately. Report by 1200 tomorrow. Sorry about cuffing the leave short, but there you go."
"It's okay, Sarge. I know you can't tell me why on the phone, but..."
"I don't even know. All I know is that all the commando-qualified personnel have been ordered back to base."
Dom didn't even remember if he said okay or not. He walked back into the yard, trying to work out if he was elated, terrified, or triumphant, or if he should call Carlos first or break the news to Maria. It could only be a mission. The thought that he could roll right out of training and into a live op was frightening. But that's what he'd done before. A 16-year-old infantry soldier, straight out of basic and into the front line. It was how things were done. He had faith in his training and in himself.
"I knew it was too good to be true," Maria said, but she managed to smile. She was getting used to being a gear's wife. "Let me know if you're going to be back in time for the birth."
"If I can. Made it back for Benedicto, didn't I?"
"I called Carlos earlier," his father said. "The whole 26th seems to be moving, not just you."
Dom told himself that there must have been hundreds of recalls like this in the past, maybe even thousands, but nothing much had changed the course of the war. He had no reason to think his task, whatever it was, would be different. He just believed that it would. He had to pack now. He hated packing. 26RTI Special Tactics Group, RHQ, Ephyra. Hoffman now knew the internal layout of Asfo Point better than he knew his own house. He spent more time immersed in it, so it was hardly surprising. If he'd ever struck lucky with Nina Cladry, she'd have left him by now for neglecting her. So once again he was reminded that it was never meant to be, and that he had his just deserts in his wife Margaret. "No, dear, I won't be home tonight. Sorry, it's work again." The saddest thing was that she didn't suspect him of having an affair, and she was absolutely right. She knew how thoroughly the military had devoured him. Hoffman paced around the briefing room table, inspecting the sole focus of his existence at doll's house size. The Asfo Point building had evolved from map to ground plan to a cutaway scale model, painstakingly constructed and detailed. The intelligence folk added little details all the time. Hoffman wondered if they actually enjoyed it. He caught himself staring at the tiny models representing troops, his arms folded on the table, chin resting on his right forearm, and found it oddly funny. A cup of coffee appeared beside his elbow. Agent Louise Satil, jangling with security passes strung from her belt like battle trophies, slurped her cup in a remarkably unladylike way. He hadn't actually heard her come in.
"When you find yourself going pew, pew, and making aircraft noises, Major, you'll know it's time to get some sleep."
She was young and not especially pretty, but she was damn good at her job, so she passed muster as a goddess as far as he was concerned.
"Aren't you going to need more men for this?"
"Not inside," Hoffman said. "Pour in too many and they end up log-jamming each other. It's securing the exterior that's critical. Buy time, delay discovery, secure the exfil route."
He straightened up and reached for the coffee.
"It would really help if we didn't have to extract any guys in white coats, though."
"You really do have a problem with Alive, don't you?"
"Are the scientists that important? I know I keep asking, but it's one more complication for us."
"We're trying to get a parallel technical team up to speed here, or as close as we can. We've got big gaps in our knowledge. We don't know how the UIR is handling global positioning, targeting, and we don't know the detail of the launch vehicle, the fuel system in particular. Our best shot on paper can't develop enough thrust to achieve the optimum orbit, and we haven't worked out acceptable accuracy for hitting targets."
Hoffman wasn't sure if that was a yes or a no, but Chairman Dalyell was clear. He wanted the key personnel in one piece.
"You're assuming they'll cooperate with you," Hoffman said.
"There's a chance."
Satil took a folder out of her briefcase.
"But if they're mashed to slurry, then they won't have the opportunity of seeing sense. Anyway, here's the latest aerial reconnaissance images. Nothing much has changed."
Hoffman took the folder and laid out the images on a free space on the table. There were coils of wire strung along the high water line, but they seemed to have been partly covered by material swept up the beach since the last recon run. It was a ferociously stormy coast.
"Given the value of this target, they don't seem to be maintaining adequate beach defenses."
Satil raised an eyebrow.
"If I didn't know you better, I'd say you think we intelligence folks are a bunch of incompetents."
"I would never offer that opinion to a lady," Hoffman said. "But you do have more than your fair share of useless assholes."
"Asfo Point is what we say it is."
"We'll take it anyway," he said, "because those are my orders."
"You're such a free thinker."
"It's my lack of free thinking that ensures there's still a civilian government running the show, ma'am."
Satil looked at him as if she was dismantling the sentence for hidden meaning, but she didn't take the bait.
"It's still pretty bad weather in Austria when you insert. They won't expect a raid of that kind until their summer, if they expect it at all."
Hoffman was only responsible for the assault on the facility itself, landing the troops to secure the wider area, naval gunfire support if needed. That was someone else's job. By noon, he had to have a better plan on paper for General Ivor.
"Captain Michelson's going to be here in a couple of hours."
Hoffman got up and walked over to the chart table to look again at the landing area. It all looked so straightforward. A deserted coast, no cliffs to worry about, and a long way from any serious reinforcements.
"What made you look here, anyway?"
Satil laid the aerial images on the chart, trying to line them up with the features.
"Production of gyroscopic components suddenly starting up in factories where we'd never seen it before. It's taken 4 years for us to get this far. I wish it were a matter of quiet industrial espionage, just copying their data and plans and getting out. But it's not enough to be first with this capability. We have to be the only power with it."
"I understand."
"You're going in personally, aren't you?"
"Of course."
"You feel left out?"
"No. I feel I've got 25 years' experience, and there are boys of 17 I'll be asking to get themselves killed, so it seems kind of lacking not to be there with them."
Hoffman rarely let any comment get to him, but these spooks were good at sowing seeds of doubt. It was their job. They probably didn't even know they were doing it, not even the likable ones like Satil. Am I going to be a liability? Am I really doing it because I can't face watching this from an ops room? There was nothing worse than a commander who didn't know when to stand back, to delegate. Hoffman didn't think he'd reached that sorry state. It was about faith, about having it in others, and letting them have it in you.
Who was it who said there was nothing like the occasional dead general for improving troop morale?
Satil asked. I'm a major, Hoffman said.
So you are, said Satil.
Chapter 8.
Maybe I don't want no cog protection. Maybe I'm worried that you assholes gonna make me give up too much to get it. And if we ever get back to normal, I ain't sure I'm even gonna like your kind of normal.
Franklin Soko, one of the stranded, declining another invitation from Dom to join the cog fold. North Gate Agricultural Depot, present day, 14 A.E. It was the chickens that started bringing back the past to Dom. As the armadillo rumbled through the security gates into the compound, he could smell them, but he couldn't see them. Cage-formed poultry smelled of sour, ammonia-saturated shit, an unfamiliar smell to his urban nostrils, but he knew exactly what it was. A sapper jogged up to the APC as Dom dismounted for instructions.
"Follow the marshals, chainsaw boy," he snapped.
He looked older than Hoffman. His name tab read Perry L., and he was a staff sergeant, a man not to be messed with.
"Keep the loading area clear. The trucks need room to maneuver. Park your dills by the gates."
Perry executed a piercing whistle, thumb and forefinger clamped between his lips. A bunch of men and women in scruff cog fatigues appeared out of nowhere.
"Okay, people, fast as you can."
This was the cog's engineering corps, soldiers that Dom rarely saw, let alone spoke to. They didn't look like they got 3 square meals a day, and he was suddenly conscious of how thin and frayed they were compared to gears like him. There was, as Hoffman put it, a hierarchy of need even within the army, front line first, support second. Dom wondered if they were as resentful of the combat gears as the stranded were. He jumped back into the driver's seat and reversed the APC against the perimeter fence, nose out for a quick exit. Marcus jumped down and stood surveying the compound. It reminded Dom of the flight deck of a carrier. The sappers had a plan, and however chaotic it looked to him, it was tried and tested. The area gradually filled with a motley assortment of vehicles, all directed to an exact position and made to repark if they didn't get it just right. He could see why now. The forklifts could barely squeeze into the gaps. Where there weren't forklifts shifting palleted crates, there were human chains manhandling boxes and sacks. He got out and climbed onto the hood of the APC with Rojas to get a better view.
"Shit, that's choreographed," Rojas said. "Awesome."
A massive crane swung polished steel vats onto the flatbed of a 16-wheeler.
"I never see these guys. How the hell did they pack all that stuff in a couple of days?"
A sapper walked past the APC.
"By not sleeping," he said. "How the fuck do you think the city keeps running when the grubs trash the water mains?"
Yeah, they were resentful. It was a shitty job, invisible and unsung. Dom watched Marcus walk a few paces with the sapper, saying something Dom couldn't hear, and took something from his belt pack to hand to him. Dom could have predicted what he'd do. There was a glint of wrapping. Ration bars weren't just informal currency. They were communication, apology, encouragement, comradeship, sympathy, and even guilt.
"Do they want a hand?" Dom called. 8 guys here with good pairs of shoulders on them. I'm counting Bernie in that.
She could hear him on the link, of course. No offense, Sergeant.
No, they say they're okay. The truck crews can take up the slack.
Marcus ambled back and motioned Dom to get off the hood so he could release Jack. The bot lifted clear of its housing and hovered patiently, testing its extending arms and waiting for instructions. Marcus pressed his earpiece.
Delta to control. We're secured at North Gate. How are we doing for time?
Delta, the last reported locust incursion was an hour ago. Also receiving reports of subsidence 2 clicks east of you.
I'm employing Jack for a recon. Handing over control to you, Lieutenant.
Thank you, Marcus.
Dom didn't say a word, and Rojas didn't seem to notice the slip into familiarity. Dom caught Marcus's eye just as Hoffman's APC pulled up and backed up next to them.
Too much water under the bridge, buddy, Marcus murmured. It's kinder that way.
For her or for you? Dom didn't ask. Hoffman stalked over to Marcus and watched Jack turn in midair to vanish over the perimeter fence. The last section of vehicles rolled through the gates, with the 3rd APC bringing up the rear.
The grubs are moving at 10 to 15 meters an hour, Hoffman said. That gives us a lot longer than estimated. But they're devious bastards, so we'll plan for the worst. They can rip up ground a lot faster than that.
Baird walked into the conversation.
Maybe they're tunneling deeper.
You got a theory, Corporal?
Yeah, Colonel, I have. We're making a lot of assumptions about what they're doing. Just because they're moving this way doesn't mean this is the objective. That's us thinking like humans, not like grubs.
Dom sometimes needed a reminder of why Baird was worth the daily food ration of 3 nice normal people. He was actually an asset. He could fight hard, and he was an excellent mechanic, but he also knew plenty about Locust. Cole claimed it was because he dated one once. However he managed it, Baird had been right about the grubs as often as the scientists. He was still alive to prove it. Hoffman looked him in the eye for a long, silent moment. Baird pulled his goggles down again and stared back.
"Even more reason to get out of here fast, then,"
Hoffman said, and walked off in the direction of Perry, who was standing on the tailgate of a truck checking off a clipboard.
"Staff, you got a minute?"
Delta Squad's normal working day was usually an uncomplicated one that left almost no time for thinking. Dom was either waiting to see what might kill him around the next corner, killing something around the next corner, eating as much as he could stuff down his throat before the next enemy contact, or falling asleep from exhaustion so overwhelming that he seldom woke up without someone shaking him or an alarm screaming in his ear. He wasn't sure what to do with this idle moment. Spare time, whenever he could steal it, was spent looking for Maria, walking the rubble-strewn streets, talking to Stranded in the hope they might have seen her.
10 years. Fuck, 10 years. What does she even look like now?
But he would not give up. Bernie Mataki had surfaced again 14 years after E-Day. Dom found himself adding that margin and giving himself the hope of extra time to find Maria, because that was how long people could survive. 14 years. 4 to go. But Bernie is a survival specialist. Maria was younger. She was in her home city. She might have... Shit. He'd done this bargaining with himself too many times before. He found he was staring down at his rifle as it hung on its sling, rubbing his fingertips along the points of the chainsaw. Bernie put her hand on his wrist.
"You could borrow my nail file, Dom."
Sometimes it helped to be interrupted.
"Hey, I remembered. You and the damn chicken."
"I was wondering how long it would take you," Bernie laughed. "Who was that lad with you, the one I had to help? Georg something or other."
"Timiyu," Dom said.
"He was killed a year after Carlos." She shook her head sadly.
I don't know why that still crimps my guts. Chances are that most gears I trained or served with are dead now.